First, I want to say I learned several things. Number one is that in order to have such a wonderful audience of men, which we don't usually get when we discuss feminist subjects, it's good to have a preparatory session on something of some other subjects. But I do welcome and appreciate the men here, and also that in feminist panels you often don't find a male coordinator, and so I appreciate that as well. We should learn not to speak to each other, but to speak to the whole community. The second thing I want to say is that one of the wonderful things about dialogue is that even though you have not met the other personally, you feel as if you are in the presence of friends. This is the powerful sensation of the dialogue encounter. And speaking about the women's issues in this context, I feel that I can speak the truth as I see it, and not that I must be on guard with my words or protect my community. Feminism offers a critique of hierarchy, and I don't feel the need to deny that hierarchy did exist in Judaism. But let me begin at the beginning. Our topic, being Orthodox and being feminist, why should there be a question about the compatibility of the two? After all, feminism is an ethical value, and Judaism is a religion of high ethical and moral content. Hebrew scriptures are the basis of ethical societies that have been built on what we call the Judeo-Christian teachings. So why should the two, feminism and Orthodox Judaism, be seemingly at odds with each other? One answer lies in the origins and development of Judaism, a religion that is almost 4,000 years old. The origins and development of Judaism are in a patriarchal society. And as I said a moment ago, patriarchals are hierarchies. Jewish patriarchy was a benevolent patriarchy, a benevolent hierarchy, which meant that women were protected, cared for, not totally vulnerable. For example, the Torah teaches that a Jewish maidservant who was taken to be a wife by her owner could not be passed around to other men. She was entitled to all the benefits of a free woman. And if her husband tired of her and wanted to divorce her, he had to set her free. He could not sell her or force her to resume her slave status. In Madison, gradually, slavery was eliminated from Judaism. Another example, in matters of divorce, the Torah laws in Deuteronomy dictate laws that were intended to protect women. In contrast to the irrevocable oral divorce, I hope the translator gets that, the irrevocable oral divorce of contemporaneous societies, in which a man could actually summon his wife to the door in a fit of anger and say three times by holding on to the doorknob, say three times, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you. And a woman was, upon hearing that, was required to leave the house immediately and empty-handed. In contrast to that irrevocable oral divorce, Jewish divorce law required that a writ of divorce must be given by a man to his wife. Now, as everybody knows, a writ or anything written, a writ of divorce was a delaying tactic, and it made a woman less vulnerable, less subject to her husband's passing moods. But equality of men and women was not a concept in Judaism. just simply was not a concept. Women could not own property. They could not serve as witness in courts of law. They could not divorce their husbands. In some instances of biblical language, wives are listed in the same categories as slaves and property. In all of Jewish history, women were rarely to be found in leadership roles. In prayer and ritual responsibilities, women were not called upon for equal performance. As is true for most religious systems, Judaism was influenced by society and culture. And for most of human history, and most cultures, men and women were not equals. As Judaism developed, first through biblical times, and then rabbinic times, and then post-rabbinic times, patriarchal laws concerning women were codified into halakha, which is the corpus of Jewish law and custom and tradition. Thus, through halakha, definitions, which were socially driven definitions of women's roles and rights, and exemptions and limitations, took on a quasi-religious status or value. Halakha, a religious legal system, is resistant to change. That is its strength and its beauty. Through halakha, you can pass on the values and teachings of the generations. Through halakha, the teachings of Torah and of the rabbis who interpreted the Torah were brought down and are brought down to our own day in the sense of the binding nature of the Word of God. And this, particularly so in contemporary society, is no small feat. On the other hand, some hierarchical laws became more so in time. For example, the fact that a man must write a writ of divorce, as I just explained in Deuteronomy chapter 24, now becomes, through time, a principle of a man's absolute right in matters of divorce. And this is the principle that plagues Jewish women today, because there are recalcitrant husbands who refuse to grant a writ of divorce to their wives and essentially hold them in virtual form of imprisonment. And contemporary rabbis will not coerce the husband because in doing so they would be violating a man's absolute right. In fairness, as time developed, some matters improved for women. Let us look at the rape laws, which are always an indicator of a society's values towards women. The Torah metes out punishment to a rapist, but it makes a difference whether the rapist victim is a married woman or a virgin. If a man rapes a married woman, he's punished by capital punishment. But if he raped a virgin, his punishment is that he pays a fine to her father and is obligated to marry her if she will have him. It seems grotesque. If he marries her, he may never divorce her. We could spend a few hours discussing these laws, which, as I said, seem grotesque, but in some aspects were a way of protecting women, but also imply the underlying what I call spoiled goods theory of women's sexuality. The spoiled goods theory of women's sexuality explains why a virgin would even consider marrying a rapist, because she was aware that no one else would have her now that her virginity was lost. The Talmud deals with a case of rape in which the rapist claims that the woman enjoyed it, which I think is probably the equivalent of our own time's concept, she asked for it. But in this same Talmudic passage, the woman protests against such a defense by the rapist that she enjoyed it. And from that time on, the law becomes that the testimony of the victim is sufficient to indict the rapist. She is not considered an accessory to the crime, as is an abominable case in so many contemporary societies, where it is considered equally her fault if she is raped. So into this complex universe of Torah and rabbinic teachings, all of which are very dear and very sacred to me, feminism intersected the scene and entered the scene and intersected my life. In the 1960s, when Betty Friedan wrote The Feminine Mystique, Orthodox women like myself were conditioned, and I would say even happy and content with secondary status. In fact, I must say that we did not see this as secondary or hierarchical, but only as differentiated with distinct roles, each gender assigned through halakha certain roles and responsibilities, each complementing or supplementing each other, and women primarily enablers. I must admit that I came to Jewish feminism more as an intellectual enterprise than through feelings of discrimination or disability. In fact, when other secular feminists and some of my liberal Jewish feminist friends and some of my Christian feminist friends would criticize halakha or the rabbis, I bristled with defense. But gradually I came to see that there were several areas where gender inequality prevailed in Orthodox Judaism and did not serve women well, comfortable though Orthodox women were with the status quo. In fact, as society grappled with feminism, with feminist values in the 60s and 70s, I came to see that there were seven particular areas in which women were disadvantaged. One was the area of learning, which is a rich source of spiritual, intellectual, religious life in the community. Women had been deprived for generations, for centuries, of institutions and access to the great rabbinic texts, the Talmud in particular. I grew up in the home of a Talmud scholar. My father studied and taught Talmud every day of his life. My father was the sweetest, kindest man and father a girl could wish for, and he was very dedicated to the Jewish studies of his daughters, and he sought the best schools for the three of us, but he simply never imagined teaching us the Talmud. A second area was liturgy. Women had different responsibilities in prayer. They were less steady, they were less mature. Women were exempt from the full obligations and consequently were not accorded the fullest rights as were men in synagogue life. Rights such as being called to the Torah, being counted in the minyan, the prayer quorum. Women in a certain sense were at the periphery of the liturgical community. A third area was rites of passage. Males merited rituals and communal celebrations at birth and at puberty, celebrations such as Brit and Bar Mitzvah. Male mourners were called upon to recite the Kaddish and found themselves in the presence of a healing community. Women were not so called and were deprived, though they did not know it, of a great healing ritual. Four, the language of scriptures and liturgy were not inclusive. God was imaged mostly in male language, and community was often considered in male terms. For example, you and your wives. Language is so powerful in shaping values, precisely because it is so subtle and so repetitive, so matter of fact and taken for granted. Five, Jewish divorce law. Still the recalcitrant husband can anchor his wife to a dead marriage, can blackmail her in return for a debt, and can render her an aguna, unable to move forward with her life without a get. just slipped my mind. Oh, I know. And in this period, in the 60s and 70s, which I'm talking about, there was much more female-initiated divorce, so the problem was exacerbated. Sixth area is leadership. In Orthodox Judaism, only men could be rabbis. In most institutions, men sat in leadership positions, and women did not. And finally, seven, in the Jewish religious courts of law, women cannot serve as witnesses nor as judges. And this impacts on marriage and divorce issues that are the purview of religious courts. So this is what it was like when feminism entered the bloodstream of modern life and permeated every corner of society. But I'm happy to say that much has changed during the past 40 years. While Orthodoxy was the most resistant of all Jewish denominations because of its commitment to halakha, a lot has changed within Orthodoxy in a period of time that is but the blink of an eye, as Jews count time. There are thousands of young women who have studied Talmud during the last 40 years, drinking it up like thirsty camels brought to the trough. Because of the connection between learning and leadership in Judaism, with scholarship being the access route to authority and to leadership, during the last 20 and 30 years of women's learning, so much has changed. Women now hold leadership positions in places that were closed to them for all previous centuries. Today we have Yoatzot Halakha, interpreters, women who are advisors and interpreters of the law. We have women who are Toanot, formal pleaders in the religious courts of law. Women are presidents of synagogues. They have principals of yeshivot, of institutions of learning. A woman recently was accepted or inducted as Rosh Kehila, head of an Orthodox synagogue, the first in all of Jewish history. I believe that we will soon see women ordained as Orthodox rabbis in the same manner that liberal Judaism has done in its rabbinic seminaries. It is just but a matter of time. Today, there have been developed birth ceremonies for baby girls. Today, no self-respecting Orthodox family would not celebrate in a communal way the bat mitzvah of its daughters. Unlike my youth, when a public celebration of a girl coming of age was considered a travesty of the tradition. These new communal ceremonies, rites vary from very widely, from reading the Torah to giving a Dvar Torah, but all share a public affirmation of a girl's, of a Jewish daughter's coming of age and being responsible as a Jew. Today there are rituals for women in the wedding ceremony in place of the silent bride of yesteryear. During the last 30 years, women's tefillah, or 35 years, women's tefillah has developed, a network of women's prayer groups where women carry on the entire traditional service with but a few exceptions. And recently, there have been developed what we call the partnership minyani in Orthodoxy, where women and men, seated separately on respective sides of the mechitza divider, share the liturgical leadership roles in the prayer service. In Jewish divorce law, there has been some progress, such as a prenuptial agreement that prevents blackmail, a man from blackmailing or withholding a writ of divorce. There are activist organizations and community anger, but I regret to say that 40 years later, I feel that here progress is really no progress, for we still have angered wives, want women anchored to recalcitrant or absentee husbands, and I feel the blame lies at the feet of today's rabbinic leadership. So this is what it feels like to be feminist and Orthodox Jew. Some days I want to toss my hat in the air and celebrate all of these gains, and much more than I have shared with you in this short time together. What I call late-breaking news almost every day, a new precedent meeting halachic parameters that becomes a halacha that now others can follow. And because we live in a time of revolution of communications and good news travels swiftly, this is exceedingly powerful in a decentralized religion as Judaism, as authority is today. Some days I feel a great sense of hope and optimism for the future, but some days I feel a sense of failure in my community to do more to integrate women fully into the rich fabric of Jewish life and into places of equality in interpersonal relationships and community institutions. So there is much work that remains to be done, but all in all, I am immensely grateful to have been born as an Orthodox Jew in this era of feminism. I am grateful that, committed as I am to equality, I did not have to leave my own community to find it, for giving up Orthodoxy would never have been an option for me. It is a wonderful heritage and a beautiful way of life, and I was blessed to receive it and privileged to pass it on to my children and watch them as they transmit those same values and way of life to their children. Some of the changes I've told you about are things that my grandchildren take for granted. I only hope that they will take advantage of the new gifts and opportunities for women that feminism has brought to Orthodoxy, and that they will also continue to take on the struggle for fuller equality, and that they will come to understand, as I have over the years, that there is room for distinctive gender roles within the framework of equality. Men and women need not be identical to be equal. And that is a gift that Orthodoxy can give to the world. For me, the struggle to be feminist and Orthodox has been more of an exhilaration than a battle. It has been the most exciting time to be alive as an Orthodox Jewish woman. And I pray that I will be granted more years to watch this encounter unfold, to engage in the challenge of feminism that feminism presents to halacha, and the challenge of eternal values of family and community and service to others, and even distinctive roles that Orthodox Judaism can challenge contemporary society. And all of us grow from this enterprise.